Hi, everybody. This is Joanne from Read Science, and I'm here once again with my co-host Jeff, who seemed to turn into a picture instead of a video all of a sudden, but he will be here. And today I am so excited to be joined by Kat Arney, who hails from the UK but is currently sitting in Toronto. Kat, why don't you go ahead and say hi before I formally introduce you?
Hi, hello, everyone.
Okay, so you guys might recognize her, maybe at least her voice, from the Naked Scientist podcast and Naked Genetics. And if not, and you want an excuse to get to know her, I'm going to highly recommend her book, Herding Hemingway's Cats, Understanding How Our Genes Work. And, of course, cats and the internet and science, they're all really good things. So I think it's perfect. So, and actually, let me introduce Kat before I talk a little bit about the book and as we wait for Jeff to return, because he usually throws out the first question. So let me find, oh, yes, let's see which document I put that in. Okay, so Dr. Kat Arney holds a degree in natural sciences and a PhD in developmental biology from Cambridge University. And she did her postdoc at Imperial College London. So she knows what she is writing about. She is a writer, broadcaster, and public speaker, appearing on the highly successful Naked Scientist for the past decade and producing and presenting the monthly Naked Genetics podcast, as well as co-presenting the weekly National BBC Radio 5 live science show. You can tell me if that's still happening.
Still happens every single week.
That's so great. That's fantastic. And now, of course, she's written this book about genetics, or how, well, not just genetics. I like to say it's genomics and molecular biology these days, right? So, because yeah. Genetics, to me, always gives that sense of Mendelian genetics. One gene, one disease, right? And we know that's just not always the case.
Absolutely. That's a lot of what I wanted to explore, was that, you know, we read about genes in the papers all the time. They make your eyes brown, they make your hair curly, they give you cancer, they make you fat. But, like, how do they work? How do they do that? So that's really what I wanted to explore.
Yeah, and you know, for me, I teach biology, obviously. I teach cell biology. I teach a course in genomics. And having taught for so many years at the university level, it's always sort of fun for me to recommend books to my students and to say, you know, if you want to sort of see the overarching view, rather than what you get in one class this semester and another class another semester, like, these books tie things together. So good examples include the Philadelphia chromosome, which you have actually mentioned in your book, and we have had Jessica Wapner on the show. Fantastic, you know, book. And the other one was P53, which was about, obviously, the P53 gene, which is implicated in cancer. And, you know, and then when I read your book, I went, oh, my goodness, this is even better, because I will tell you, I was like, at the time, RNAi, we'll talk about that more, was sort of being discovered and papers being written. I was like busy raising children and not paying attention to that. And I was like, oh, my gosh, you know, I just, even at that point, I felt so grateful that you had sort of explained it clearly and lucidly. Yeah, it was fantastic. So since Jeff will probably join us in a moment.
We've lost him into the ether somewhere.
I think so. Well, he usually films from home, you know, on his day off. But now he's trying it from his office. And I think, you know, I don't know if it's the internet or maybe someone policing and saying, no, you can't be doing this, right? Yeah, exactly. I don't think that's the case. So, why don't we talk a little bit, just start a little bit about, since on this show we talk not only about the science, but how this process of science communication happens. Why don't you try to condense, like, your path of science communication and how that led to this book? Or you know, you can even go step back as far as, you know, I was working on a PhD and said, yeah, I don't want to apply for grants, or whatever it is that motivated you to step towards communication and then to the book.
So I've always loved writing. And I love books. I've always been a big reader, a big writer. And when I was at school, I was always kind of torn between, do I go into more the art side or the science side? I'm a musician as well. I come from a very musical family. I kind of half the family is writers and sort of arty people. And then the other half are accountants and, you know, those sort of sciencey type people. So I've always had this pull in my life, but I realized that I really liked science. I was really good at science. At school, I did all of that. Went to do a degree in science at Cambridge and a PhD. But it was during, I think during the end of my degree, I really started doing science writing. I was entering science writing competitions. I started writing for the university newspaper about science, all that kind of thing. Got involved in the Naked Scientists for the first time. And yeah, that kind of gave me the bug. But then I thought, no, I've been told all my life I'm a scientist, I'm going to be a scientist, you know. I did really well at school and did really well at university. And so I started doing my PhD. I'm very, very clumsy. So I had a real problem. Like, I was just dropping things and breaking things. And when you're working with tiny, tiny embryos, it's difficult. And at the same time, I was doing all this science communication. I was writing. I was doing talks for kids and all those kind of things. And again, sort of doing more with the Naked Scientists. And I still thought, no, 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 I have to be a scientist. I'm going to be a professor. My mum will be so proud. Decided that I was going to do a postdoc, got to London to do a postdoc. There's kind of a sort of loop where I wanted to go to the US, I wanted to go to Vienna, I wanted to go to Edinburgh, but my partner at the time didn't want to go, so I followed him, and that was a big mistake. Don't do that, ladies.
Yes.
Not when you're that young, anyway. So I ended up very, very unhappy in the lab, but still really enjoying all the communication and loving science, but not being a scientist. And I had quite a bad period of depression where I just didn't know what to do with my life because I thought I was a scientist, but I could feel this, no, you're a writer, you're a talker, you love science. And then realized, I mean, this was about 12 years ago, that there was a career called science communication. It was kind of quite new back then. There weren't that many of us. And I applied for a job as a junior at the charity Cancer Research UK. And I was there for 11 and a half years and I'd just gone freelance.
Okay. Oh, you broke away.
Yeah. So as the book came out, you know, there were more and more opportunities to do talks, to do more writing. So finally, I've run my freelance writing career alongside being a science communicator at CRUK. They've been very tolerant of that. But finally, I've sort of reached escape velocity, I guess. So that's kind of how I got here.
It's, well, you know, it seems cancer. What could you repeat that again? Cancer Research.
Cancer Research UK. They're the yes, UK's biggest yes. research charity.
Right. So Ed Young got his start there too. So you know.
Oh yeah, he was my colleague. Yeah, we did a blog together at CRUK. And, you know, we won awards and it was absolutely great.
So maybe the Cancer Research UK in their benefits. You could possibly break free and become a great, well-known science communicator.
I have to say, as somewhere to learn how to communicate science and a great environment, it was fantastic. And I miss my colleagues there so much. If you're watching, guys, I miss you.
Well, I hope they are. That's so fantastic. So actually, I just noted, I'm distressed Jeff is missing because he would have these great questions from the viewpoint of a physicist who's still grappling with biology. But I noticed you mentioned this, that your name on Twitter is Harpist Cat.
Yes.
And this is because you play the harp and you must play it quite well.
That's a matter of opinion. I play in a couple of bands and I do weddings and things like that. And it's something I've done for a long time. And I try not to cross the streams. My sister is a musician and a science comedian, and she sings songs about science. But I don't cross the streams in that way. I do, you know, I do my own music stuff, and I keep the science separate. But yeah, it's nice to have that takes me completely away from it.
Right. Well, and I think it's important, you know, that scientists, you know, continue to let the world know that we are multidimensional. We aren't merely, you know, in the lab, even though we could definitely be in the lab all day, every day. And many of us certainly have tried.
Yeah.
You know, it's good for other people to know,
yeah,
you know, that we're multidimensional, that we aren't just science.
And that's kind of why I wanted to do the book like I have. So the book is all about first-person interviews because I love talking to scientists. And that's how I find out about their work. I go around and I talk to them and I say, you know, tell me what's hot, tell me what's weird. And they were telling me all this stuff. And I thought, you know, I have to do this book as interviews, as the story of me meeting these people and talking to people, because they have characters. They're some of them quite grumpy, or they're fun, or they have, you know, they're figuring things out. These aren't necessarily questions that we have all the answers to. So I think trying to portray scientists as real people that have disagreements and views and characteristics and traits, I think is very important.
Yes, you did. Every chapter started with, you know, hey, I got on the elevator and with my, you know, you had your coffee of choice of the day and, you know, and, yes. And then you were heading towards, you know what I mean? It was like, and I was invited to their office. You described their office, you some traits of the scientists. And then, you know, the conversation, the way you shared the conversation, it could have been very dry, but no, you shared, like, you know, you made it colorful and you made it, you know, I don't know. It was very interesting. And I like that. Instead of being like, yes, I interviewed these people or third person, oh, he does this. It was really like you had this conversation and you were like then turning around to tell us, hey, you know, I met the most interesting person today.
Because I love that. I love sitting in the pub with people and saying, oh my God, so I was working on this great story today. There's this, you know, there's this woman who's discovered X, Y, Z. I have to tell you about it. That's the thing I love doing. And I don't know, hopefully my friends aren't too bored a bit. But I absolutely love just telling people about great stories I found. And so when it came to writing the book, it was like, yeah, it's like sitting in the pub, having a beer with me, and I'll tell you these stories.
So how many people did you interview? It was a lot.
Oh, gosh, I think in total it was over 40. And I transcribed them all. I could have written like 3 books from the transcripts. I think I had over 200,000 words of transcription by the time, wow, I'd finished. And then I hacked that down. So I think there are about 20 people's stories in total. And it was really hard to decide who stays in, who goes out. There are a couple of chapters that got axed. So maybe they will appear somewhere else in another form, perhaps one day. But yeah, everyone I spoke to shaped my thinking, because what I didn't want to do was just write a kind of, oh, this is what I think, this is what I've read. And also, like, in genetics, there are kind of arguments going on at the moment about how much of the genome is junk, what do these different types of RNA do, can we inherit non-genetic characteristics through the germline, through the generations. And yeah, talking to people, coming up with where do I think we are. This isn't a very neutral book. I'm definitely in one camp with the kind of the grumps and the skeptics on this. So it's quite different from some other books that have been written on a similar topic lately in the past kind of year or so.
Yeah. Well, and I fall into this thing, of course, being a cell biologist and an educator and having read a lot of books. Sometimes I'll just go, another genetics book, you know, but then usually I'm very glad I've read it. You know what I mean? So like even yours, I went, another one. Well, how is she going to be different? And it was different enough and you know, enough information. I went, oh, thank goodness. Oh, you know, I love this book. Now it's easy for me to go read this book. Come on. You know, and I even think, you know, I'll refer to it as I'm sort of refreshing my course for the summer, the genomics course. Because if we do fall, here's one thing that really, we can talk about epigenetics here. Because epigenetics, just, you know, the quick and dirty is, oh, it's methylation of this, of the histones, and then it doesn't fold properly, and therefore, you know, it leaves it more open and more able to be transcribed. But you went into so much more detail. It's not just like, not detail as in, let's talk about every little thing. It was like, no, but epigenetics is also this, and it's also this, and it's also this. And that was, you know, I was like, oh, what a wonderful way to encapsulate everything. Yeah.
I mean, I worked on epigenetics before it was cool. That's what I did my PhD in. And I think it's a word that's so badly abused. It really needs to be in therapy. You know, it's become like the quantum of biology. So you get people like Deepak Chopra and people who don't really understand biology going, oh yes, it's epigenetic, right? Anything we don't understand or is a bit kind of weird. And
whatever you ate yesterday, that is going to, you know, influence everything, or your thoughts. What you thought, that's changing your DNA. And I'm like, oh my gosh, stop.
yes, of course, our genes change in their level of activity all the time. And that's how cells work. They sense a change and they respond, and genes go on and genes go off, and that's kind of how it works. But yeah, it's all become tied up with this, does it go through the generations? And then anyone who's a particular aficionado of this, there's been a wonderful argument raging over the past week or so about an article about epigenetics that was written by Siddhartha Mukherjee, who I think is an incredible writer, and his book, The Emperor of All Maladies, is amazing.
My favorite. It's one of my favorites.
Incredible cancer book. I read it on my honeymoon, which was, I don't know what that says about me. He's kind of got into trouble, I think, for falling into some traps about epigenetics that I worked really hard to avoid in my book, because I knew that they were there. And a lot of the people that I spoke to was like, don't fall into this mistake. The epigenetic stuff, the marks, all these kind of things, they're not the magic. They're not necessarily as important as we think they might be. But there are sort of these underlying mechanisms that are very important as well. So there's a lot of confusion, I think, even in the field of scientists and science communicators about what epigenetics is. So I really did spend a lot of time getting my thoughts straight and working out, okay, what exactly can we say about this that is true? And what is kind of the hand wavy stuff?
Right. And I personally, I think, if nothing else, that is one great reason to get your book.
Because, if you want to know what epigenetics actually is, it's in my book.
Right. If you feel like, oh, it's just this, if you could give a knee-jerk response that you think it's just this, then you are probably wrong and you should, you know, read this to get a better idea. So, yeah, I was actually going to ask, you know, if, of course you would have followed the whole thing with Siddhartha Mukherjee, because I love his book. His book is out today, just for those of you watching who might be. It's out today, The Gene.
And I ordered it. I'm going to have it when I get home from Canada then.
Oh, great. Oh, that's so great. Yes, I have mine and I need to start reading it. But I've had a fun weekend with my kids, some kids graduating, birthdays, blah, blah. One returning from Ecuador. So, yeah, I've been a little busy. But it's there was a part of me that thought, oh, I love Emperor of All Maladies. He's an oncologist. He's, you know, so it's his area. So there's a part of me that's a little dubious. So how is he going to do with the gene? And then when this article came out and people, you know, trounced him on that one, I was like, oh, no, you can't, it can't be true. I want him to be a great writer about the gene too, but we'll see. We'll see. I have to read and make my own assessment.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a lot of books about genetics, but it's always interesting to see what individual people bring, because I couldn't talk to everyone. I've made my tent in the camp that I'm in, and there are different opinions and there's different, you know, people have evidence from different sources. Some people do this experiment on all these things and they come up with this answer. Some people do very fine detailed experiments on a tiny number of cells and they have different answer. So there are different stories to be told in a narrative. So I think it's always interesting reading what other writers take from the people that they talk to and the papers that they read. So yeah, I will be very interested to read about it, because I think, you know, I did an event with a guy who's a psychologist in the UK. It's been a bit of fuss where he basically thinks that no psychological traits are in the genes at all. And I did an event with him, and he actually said, I think we know everything there is to know about genetics now.
No.
We are, it feels like we're really just opening that box now. And it's an incredibly exciting time to be thinking about genetics, to be writing about it, to be talking to these people, because there's just such an incredible feeling of excitement that we're really starting to find stuff out now, whereas maybe we were kind of struggling before. So it's a good time to be learning and to be communicating about genetics.
Yes, I agree. You know what? I'm going to see if we can get Jeff to ask a question before he disappears. We're so excited you're back, Jeff. Can you hear us?
I can hear you. I can see you. Everything is fine. But I'm cursing technology right now.
So, well, we've talked about many things, but I trust your question will be a little different. If not, I'm sure Kat won't mind going over.
That's right. I have to catch up. Fortunately, this is being video recorded, so I could watch the entire thing later and see what I missed. But here, if I can find it, after rebooting the computer and
no. Sorts,
yeah, it was one of those days. So this is where I was going to start, and I wanted to start with sort of the big thing that we could shape down and get through all of these various topics in the book that you organized so well. I was going to say, when I was young, and this is going to be like pre-Cretaceous, but I was younger, we normal people understood very well the genes mapped onto characteristics, that there was a gene for red hair, there was a gene for a nose's shape, there was a gene for eye color, you name it, there was a gene for it. And to use a phrase that you wrote in the book, you said the progression from genotype to phenotype for us was much simpler then. And now it's different, so I have another quote from what you said. One mutation, one effect, one G fault, one disease, it would be nice and neat, wouldn't it? Yet, everything we know about biology says that it's completely wrong. And I think that's exciting, but it's like, what happened? What's been going on for the last year? How did we, back then, and this is another thing I've noticed, back when I was in high school, the big question in anything, I don't know, that had to do with development was, how did cells differentiate? And that question has gone away because the context has shifted so much and we understand things so much differently. And so however you want to do that, it's like, the big overview, but a lot of stuff has happened, which you cover, but what's the big picture? What has been going on that has changed this picture so much, and how has it changed?
I think this is an excellent question to follow up what we were just talking about, so it's good.
I think one of the things that has changed is being able to read the sequence of DNA, being able to like really look at all the letters that are there, to be able to zoom in and see what molecules, what these things called transcription factors that turn genes on and off, what's stuck where, what's doing what. We know more about, we were talking about this idea of epigenetics, the kind of the switches on top of the switches that keep genes locked on or locked off, perhaps, maybe. Depending how cynical you are about these things. Yeah, but just the amount of molecular knowledge we have is now incredible. But I think that there is this mistaken idea that a gene is for a trait. But there's no such thing as a gene for a disease. Or, there's no such thing as the toe gene. So the book's called Herding Hemingway's Cats because these cats have extra digits. But there's no such thing as, like, the toe gene. It's not a fault in a toe gene. It's a fault in a molecule that helps cells decide, are you going to be a digit or not a digit? So genes are recipes that make molecules in our cells. And it's getting that idea of what do these molecules do? So we've gone from a sort of very Mendelian idea that there's this genetic change and you get a trait. That the fruit fly, so the fruit fly work that was done a century ago is a really good example of that. You make a change in a fruit fly and they have red eyes or white eyes or curly wings or something like that. It's a really obvious change. But you have to drill down and go, no, because there isn't such a thing as a gene for curly wings. there was a molecular change in a recipe in that fly's cells that has changed the sort of molecular makeup of those cells. So now, as the wings grow, they do something different. So kind of getting that across, that these are molecular recipes that our cells use, and then how do all our cells work together to make us who we are, and how do all these recipes work? That's kind of what we're trying to understand now. And it's a complicated picture now, unfortunately.
but it's interesting and complicated, yes, but if you have a good tour guide, thank you for your book, you could make it through it. And there are a couple of things where you've pretty much convinced me through the book that gene is hardly a concept worth trying to use if you want to speak precisely about things. And I do like to do things precisely because I'm a physicist. Now, from that physicist view, a physicist-type insight was, it seems like from 40 years ago, we've shifted from what I would describe as a static field picture. Here's a gene. It causes these noses, these eyes, these things, to this time-dependent developmental idea. And so not to be all evo-devo and things, but that developmental picture that DNA, through all these various mechanisms, controls development and not results.
Yeah.
You get to the phenotype by going through all of this. And I felt really... observant when I realized that 30 years ago, when you saw a clone in a movie, someone would contribute some cells, they would grow a clone, the clone would be 32 years old. We understand now that you can make clones, but that they have to go through this developmental process to express that genotype.
Yeah.
It's like, this is a big shift, this static to dynamic thing, and once you open up that idea of processes, you get like 10 chapters in your book, right?
Yeah, one of the analogies that I came up with, I think I came up with this when I was really drunk at a party trying to explain to someone how it worked, which is where I have all my great ideas. But it was the idea of the video game. So, you know, if you play a video game,
yes.
And the analogy I use, it's like kind of a quest. You start in a dungeon, it's just you. And you have to go through all the levels. You have to pick up the weapons. You have to learn the skills. You have to get the moves. You have to unlock the next stage. You can't just skip to the rescue at the end. You can't just jump and skip any of these levels, because every level is setting you up for the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that idea of development. And so I talk a lot in the book about this idea of control switches. So you get molecules that sit on the control switches and turn a gene on, and that helps, say, a cell become a muscle cell or a nerve cell or a finger cell. And every time I give talks about this, people say, but what turns the switches on to make those molecules? And you're like, okay, so we have to go back. And then we have to go back, and you end up going all the way back to the fertilized egg, where these kind of changes and these switches start going on, genes get turned on, genes get turned off, cells divide, cells specialize, and eventually you've built a human, and then our genes as an adult respond to our environment and changes in information that's coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So you sort of, I end up doing like a potted developmental biology, epigenetic, molecular biology talk. I do it in 45 minutes to people sitting in a pub. That's what I do now.
But one insight, I guess, or observation that one of your interviewees said, you were talking about, I'm looking now, Marie Claire King. And you said in 1975, she wrote a science paper in which she said, and I think you're paraphrasing, that it must be that the way genes are used and not the proteins they encode that make us so different from our closest relatives. And this is once you can shift your mind, right? If we are virtually identical in the genome to chimpanzees, how can we be so different from chimpanzees? And that has to say, it's not in the encoding, it's in how the encoding guides something else, right?
Yeah. So basically our proteins, the bits of the actual genes in our genome, that 2% of our genome that is honest to God protein coding, that's pretty much identical between us and chimps. I mean, there are some arguments around the edges. I've talked to some people who say, no, no, that the tiny differences that are there are important. I talk to other people who say, no, they're not. It's kind of, you know, apples and oranges. Until you start doing experiments where you're swapping in.
Yes.
I gave a talk at Google and someone was like, how many things would you need to swap to turn a human into a chimp? Like, okay, Google's next project is getting pretty dark.
Yes, but we know the answer pretty much.
We know the answer. And one of the chapters in the book, I've talked to a guy in Cambridge called Duncan Odom. He's looked at 20 different species of mammals. And he finds, yeah, that the protein coding genes, the genes are pretty much the same. But it's the switches that evolve and shuffle very dramatically. And that's kind of, you know, what makes the difference. All mammals are kind of the same. Yep. We've all got a head here, a tail here, liver, kidneys, lungs, heart, you know, reproductive organs. We're basically sophisticated mice. Yes. We just have smaller ears and less hair. But, you know, it's that the switches move and change through evolution. And that's really one of the things that first got me into writing the book, was learning about the Hemingway cats, because they had a change in the control switch, and that's made a change in their body shape. And then there's a lovely story about some sticklebacks, where just a very small change is the difference between two species of sticklebacks, and one has a pelvis with these kind of death spikes sticking out of it, and the other species doesn't. And
where did that come from? But and here's sort of a real question that comes from that, I think, that you were talking about who has the most letters in their genome. And it turns out to be this stupid plant in China has the biggest genome of anyone, outdoing this toad over here. I can't even remember what it was now, or this onion or leek, I guess, you know, some allium of some sort. How much has human hubris, our need to be at the pinnacle of, you know, the evolutionary ladder, gotten in the way of seeing how genes are actually turning on, turning off, and expressing things, just because we think ours should be the most complicated. We should have the most genes. We should have the biggest DNA. And that's not a good scientific attitude, is it?
No, I mean, I remember when I was doing my PhD, so this was like the end of the 90s, the beginning of the 2000s, and it was just around about the time they were coming close to getting the first draft of the human genome. And we would all blithely say, oh yeah, there's about 100,000 genes in the human genome. This was just bandied around commonly in scientific circles. And I talk to some people now, and they go, oh, no one who knew anything ever said that. We always thought there were fewer. And you go, yeah. In a lot of scientific circles, it was this idea, because they worked out there's about 20,000 genes in a fruit fly, there's about 20,000 genes in a nematode worm. We make hundreds of thousands of proteins, so we're going to have hundreds of thousands of genes. But no, we don't. We have about 20,000 actual genes. One of the things that I do end up exploring at the end of the book is kind of what is a gene anyway? And there's a lot of arguments about how much of the genome that we call non-coding, we must not call it junk, that pisses me off, how much of the non-coding genome is useful, is not useful. There are some very raging arguments going on about this. But there has been this idea that the genome, and I think, and you know, I'm obviously aware that you guys are in the US, and I hate to criticize US people, but the intelligent design creationists have got a lot to answer for here.
Fair enough, we're not going to argue with you on that. Somehow
the genome was designed and everything in it has a role and is important. And this is simply not true. That there is stuff that is just there. And I think a good analogy that I'm using quite a lot is, you know how everyone's got that box of cables that they have in their house? And when you move house, you take the box of cables, you take the box of cables with you. And, you know, some of them are defunct, some of them might come in useful, some of them, like, I'm sure this fits something, and some of them are genuinely just, like, you just pick this up, you know. And our genome has junk in it. It's not perfectly crafted and designed, and it's not winnowed by evolution to be you know, the pinnacle of our species. None of us is the pinnacle of our species. We're a work in progress.
No, evolution is much more opportunistic than that. And I think understanding these mechanisms is maybe the best way or the surest way to open people's eyes to the fact of how silly the argument is. How can you, you know, how could you have a gene for the eye come about all at once? And it's like, clearly, once you have this developmental picture, these evolutionary mechanisms, these various control issues, that's just a ridiculous question, almost as ridiculous as cell differentiation or something.
Yeah, and the sticklebacks are a really great example, because a tiny change, it's like a couple of hundred letters that just kind of gets cut out. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, this is a random mutation, just happens. It's the difference between having this pelvis structure with these kind of protective spikes.
Right.
So that structure is completely missing, because the control switch means that an important gene doesn't get turned on at the right time in development to help these fish build the pelvis and the spikes. And that's happened in 10,000 years, which is like the blink of an eye in evolutionary terms. And so you can actually, when you start to hear those stories, you can see how, you know, the argument that, oh, we haven't had enough time on Earth for species mm-hmm. to evolve and all these differences to accumulate, that is simply not true, because that's assuming that evolution proceeds by single letter changes in the DNA and is this very slow creeping, mm-hmm. bit bigger, bit smaller, bit fatter, bit thinner, you know, that idea. But if you start fiddling with the switches, you can make really dramatic changes.
And
then you can start getting really big differences.
Which brings me to maybe the last two questions of this period or something, Joanne, but, you know, reading these layers of things, so here's the genome, here's the DNA, it's making proteins, these are going out and making other proteins that are going off and doing work, and then you have switches over here that turn these on and off during developmental thing, fine, and you have methylation that affects something, you have things that come in and snip things and move things around, all these layers of processes. And I can see that. We can build them up. I'm happy with that reductionist, unreductionist approach. I had a remaining question, and the simple one first, I think, is a lot of those are more prone to selective pressures and evolution operation, presumably at different rates.
Yeah.
And that's what we were just starting to get at, is that a lot of these things could change a lot faster and do evolutionary experiments a lot more successfully and a lot broader. And the remaining question I had that I didn't get the answer to was, what's controlling the control mechanisms? So are these things that switch things on and off, but then clearly, you know, there's something that's controlling those or controlling the snipping or controlling the methylation. Do we know about those things too?
Yeah, no, I mean, all of those things are proteins, they're enzymes. So you have these enzymes that put on the epigenetic marks, you know, the marks on top of DNA or on top of the proteins that package DNA, these things called histones.
Yep.
So those are enzymes, and some of them do jobs at particular times in development. Some of them kind of get switched on by signals coming in from outside cells.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's kind of tracking back through development right back to the egg, that every stage sets up getting the right things in the right place to set the next stage up. So, you know, the molecules that you need to make a muscle cell, you have to go back to when the first little clump of cells in a tiny embryo was specialized as being, okay, we're going to be the middle layer of the embryo. And then a group of those, you know, changes happen in them, or they realize they're in the right place and they're getting the right information from other cells to go, okay, let's turn these things on. And then they start making the journey towards becoming muscle when they go through mm-hmm. those steps. So, you know, we only have 20,000 genes, but the combinations of them and the order that they get used, that's how we get this diversity.
And you showed some mechanisms that say even when one gene is being controlled and doing all of its hierarchy of things, how that happens depends on whether the same one is present in the second chromosome over that matches it, whether there's another gene over here someplace 10,000 10 kilojoules.
You know, and you get all these wonderful things, away. You know, kind of cutting and pasting of the RNA, the message that's kind of copied from DNA. There's one example that they use. There's a gene called DSCAM in Drosophila, which is involved in helping Drosophila's, the fruit fly, helping its nerve cells wire up in the brain. It makes sure that cells are all different in the brain and don't short-circuit by wiring into each other, into the same cell. And so this single gene is snipped up. It's made in like, I think it's something like 28,000 different versions from one gene. It's absolutely incredible. Is that the most efficient way of doing it? Who knows? It's the way that the flies have evolved to make sure that they build a brain that works.
What, the collection of proteins that are in the brain at the ends of nerve cells in the brain that are all different mutations and made in different combinations.
It's just incredible. Were
apparently what turns out to be a good reason.
Yeah.
What an evolutionary mess it was.
I think the thing that really has got me, there's been a couple of things that have really solidified for me just how incredible biology is. And also that evolution explains how we got here and how we work, is that these are incredibly inefficient processes. Mm-hmm. Most of these things in our cells, they're, you can tell the way things work, they've kind of been botched together. So, like, you can see that, oh, something was kind of working, and then something, another process happened to be there and got dragged in. You know, there was nothing neat and designed about most of the biological processes we have in our cells.
Yeah.
You could, if you were an engineer, a process engineer, you could design them way more efficiently.
Back in the earliest days of the Macintosh computer, there was this funky little program whose sole purpose was to make the computer run 10,000 times slower. And it would be amusing for a little bit, and what you would do is you would go and click on a file menu, and you would watch the menu get drawn. And the most interesting thing to me about that was that you'd see the outline come down, and you'd see the little lines go across, and you'd see shading come in, and then it'd erase it and do it over again. And you'd like to think, wouldn't those engineers have just done that once? Wouldn't that be more efficient? But, you know, it's a big enough process. It's like evolution. In a flash of an eye, you don't see it at real speed, but slow down, the mechanism for accomplishing that is horribly wasteful.
There's clunky things, and there's redundancy, and there's, like, you know, genes that seem to apparently do the same things. And sometimes that's actually useful, and the reason that they're there is that as conditions change, sometimes it's useful to have backups or as things get broken, you know. So stuff has evolved to be there, but it's not the most efficient. And the other thing that really blew my mind when I realized it is that everything, all of this, how our genes work, how our cells work, fundamentally, and you're like this, boils down to physics.
Yes.
And as a biologist, I was so upset when I realized this, that, oh God, it's actually physics. That we're dealing with things on an atomic level. These are molecules, real molecules, not lines drawn in a scientific paper with little boxes and circles sitting on them. These are molecules and shapes of molecules interacting together. And those interactions can be wobbly. And that some are more stable and some are less stable. And that's what determines whether a gene is more active or less active.
Yes.
And these are fundamentally stochastic, random. These are fundamentally random processes.
No, I like the word stochastic, but...
I like how you said it several times in the book, and you said, yes, we like to say that. And you know what? I will say one thing. Not only is it physics, but of course it's chemistry, which is really that's physics. I remember someone getting really upset. Why do the biologists keep winning, like, awards? Like, why do they keep winning the chemistry Nobel Prize? And when it comes down to it, though, cells do chemistry really, really well, you know, essentially. Then, of course, it's really physics. But still.
But it's organized chemistry.
Yeah.
And what's basically happening is that these molecules don't know where to go. They're kind of moving around, and they find a place on the DNA that fits, that feels comfy. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, a change in a letter of DNA, that makes them fit better or not so good. And that's how a gene might be more or less active, if there's kind of very subtle changes. in the DNA sequence around
as
it.
As a committed reductionist, I'm happy to see those connections being made.
And as a physicist, I'll bet, yeah.
And you mentioned, you know, butterflies in there. And so as a researcher who worked in the early days of chaos and turbulence matters and things like that, that's also nice to see. And it's always... Yeah, at the same time that I sort of look on with an air of superiority, go, that happens. It's nice to see complexity develop, you know, emerge from these things. But it all underscored for me in the biological picture how opportunistic evolutionary mechanisms are and how brilliant that is. Not that anybody designed it, because who would make a mess like that? But it's like, what an amazing, amazing, amazing thing it is that these things keep getting bent into shape, and through all these stochastic mechanisms and randomness, you've got uncountable numbers of varieties and changes. And
the endless forms ever wonderful, or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Endless forms most beautiful. Yeah.
It is incredible. But yeah, it's organized chemistry, and I think that does make it challenging to really pin down in a very reductionist way, yes, this gene absolutely does this, that gene absolutely does that. Because another of the things that surprised me that I learned was that, you know, where maybe at school we learn about this, you have one gene fault that leads to one trait and one disease, actually we're now we're starting to sequence more people's genomes. We're taking, instead of taking people who have a disease or a condition and looking in their genomes and saying, okay, what's wrong? And going, you have a fault in that gene, that's why you got breast cancer. We're taking people who are completely healthy and rifling through their genomes and going, you have this gene that means you should be ill, but you're not. Mm. And we're all walking around with changes that should be potentially damaging or harmful to our health, but they may not express themselves.
Yeah.
So it's the combination of everything you've got together, plus this biological wobble, plus the influence of your environment, that makes you who you are and how healthy you are and all this kind of stuff. And that's
hard to
figure out.
Whole reductionist spectrum that you have going on here, then, how do you... The big problem is knowing where to stop, right?
Yeah.
Maybe where to begin. So the question as an author and communicator is like, any tips for how to organize material like this?
Don't do it the way I did it. I don't know. I've never written a book before. I've never written anything longer than like 5,000 words. And so it was a learning experience for me as well. Writing that book, I just talked to a whole bunch of people and said, what are the stories here? Mm-hmm. And started to thread them together like beads on a string. And so hopefully kind of I pull people through this story, because it's as much as my discovery of what's going on.
It's almost that you organized chapters. I mean, there's a sense of progression through these mechanisms and things, but also a feeling that each one is sort of coalescing around a central story told by one person that you talk to. And I think there's a fine line there, because Joanne would have heard me say before, I hate cult writing that sees, you know, scientists as some sort of god or something. But that doesn't mean that I don't think avoiding personalities is necessarily called for either. And so it's nice to see some people, but that what we're getting out of them is not their personal story, but their scientific story. And that seemed to work quite well with some other organizational ideas going on.
I really hate that whole kind of, there was a very clever man and he did a great thing, because it's always a man. I hate that kind of thing, because scientists are opinionated, and, you know, I am a scientist by training. I have been to so many scientific conferences. I sit and I get drunk with them and we chat. And it's that I want to capture. When the guard is down, when they're not being the great scientist, it's like, what do you really think? What's confusing? What's weird? You know, tell me what's actually going on.
Yeah, and what might be the future and things like that. So actually, since we're sort of talking about how the book was organized and what the feel of the book is, you had some colorful language. I won Jeff over with the word saucy. I said, this book is saucy.
It's saucy.
Yeah. Saucy Molecular Biology. And did your editor go, awesome, love that tone, this is great, or did they go, this might go to an American audience. Some of them will like this.
my editor is great, and he's been fantastic. He's a guy called Jim, who also I go out and get drunk with quite a lot. I do that a lot. He really loved the tone. It's a very chatty conversational book. It's kind of, if you spend any time sitting around chatting to me, it's exactly how I speak, and probably a bit more sweary in real life. But yeah, there's a bit of swearing. I was made to take some of it out.
Mm-hmm. But still.
It's not a book that totally preys on all the pop, you know, there's not too much pop culture, clever stuff in there.
But in the midst of all the conversational stuff, this is just a short one, Joanne. Joanne knows that I keep hammering people on the idea of precision of their writing and not getting things wrong. But there is one commendable thing. It's like, even in the midst of a chatty, comfortable, casual sort of thing, you can still do good science and present it carefully. And so there's one place where I made a note where you were about to say, every cell in your body, I think you were going to finish by saying, has the same DNA, except you put in a footnote. You said, except red blood cells, which lose their DNA as they mature. I really approved of that, because if you had just said, every cell in your body does this, I might have said, everyone? And then I would have been stuck. And so, but making it a footnote seemed appropriate to me.
I'm a pedant. I'm a real pedant, and that kind of stuff really bugs me. I'm full of putting in the, every cell in your body has the same DNA, more or less.
More or less.
It's more or less. How much detail do you need? Well, but it's really important to me that it's scientifically correct, but without being overly detailed.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this is the problem with science communication, right? When we're trying to reach a general audience or an interested general audience, maybe they're not scientists, is the thing they say about science communication. Oh, you want to make it brief and succinct, but scientists always want to qualify. Well, yes, in this instance, or sometimes no, maybe, possibly. You know, like, because we recognize where science is not solid, especially in our field, so we're just sort of like, well, not exactly, but when you're trying to communicate, the reader, you're going to lose the reader if you keep saying that. But I felt like you struck a good balance where you said, some of this is still controversial. Some of this is so tell us a little bit about how you feel, because you do podcasts. Boy, those podcasts had better be succinct, and let's say this, and let's get our audience, and let's, also get the science right.
Exactly. And I think that's about letting the scientists tell the story, but then also engaging, and I'll always put in asides, or it's about knowing your subject. I spend a lot of time reading scientific papers, going to conferences, talking to scientists, so that I really know the story, so that I can help scientists tell the story. Because I think that sometimes science journalists can fall into that, I'll just ask these questions and whatever they say, that must be true. I think that really knowing my stuff is very important to me. And actually, it was one of my favourite reviews was from Nature, the scientific journal. That was, I got a great review, and I was like, yes, I'm a scientist. I got this kind of more or less right. That, I have to admit, I will confess, there are some mistakes in the book. I leave it as an exercise to the reader to figure those out. But yeah, there are a couple of factual errors. Some people have pointed out a couple of things to me. But
I think it's inevitable, though. It's inevitable, unfortunately.
Yeah. There's there's one I think I've got the month when they give out the Nobel Prizes wrong. I'm like, I don't even know how that happened. I think I wrote, I've said they're in December when they're not, and I think I must have written December at some point elsewhere.
But the presentation is in December, but they call them in October.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. Yes.
These things, I'll correct them in the paperback, it's fine.
That's right, you can, so we'll have to make sure to get the paperback.
Yeah.
comb through and make sure it's whatever. So, Jeff, do you have any other
questions? I had one that I was saving for the very end or near the very end. Because, and it's Kat's fault because she was... She was writing, and this is early on in the book, you were writing about a conversation you were having with, I think I miswrote it, but is it Dan Grain?
Dan Grain.
Yeah.
It's my favorite.
And you said to him, what's the one thing you want people to understand about what's in our genome and how it works? Well, guess what your question is. What's the one thing now that you want to have people know about the genome and how it works or doesn't work, knowing that the book sets out to try to clarify many of our naive misunderstandings, I think we could assume that that's understood.
I think that it's that there is no such thing as a gene for. It's really getting across the idea that genes are the recipes our cells use to make them work. It's this amazing recipe book. And it's how that all works together. That's what makes us who we are. And then from that, you can infer as much it's complicated as you like. But yeah, so getting away from this, that it's a very sort of linear one gene, one thing, that these are, it's a wonderful kitchen of ideas, of recipes.
Yep, I think that's a very good answer.
It's great. So now that Jeff asked that, I do want to give you the opportunity. Is there anything that we should have asked you that we didn't, that you might want to let, that you go, oh gosh, I have my moment to talk to however many people find me on YouTube later?
Buy my book. No, I really think it's a fantastic time to be learning about genetics, and we're all going to have to grapple with this. You know, people are getting, a couple of friends of mine have just had their 23andMe genomes done, and they're kind of coming and asking me all these questions. I had a friend of mine who got his results back and said, wow, I thought I was purebred British, but this suddenly says a quarter of my genomes come from Europe. You know, have my grandparents been lying to me? No, this is how it works, it's complicated. And so I think, at a point in the not too distant future, we're going to be getting medical results that involve our genomes, our genetics affects how we respond to certain drugs, our risks of diseases, you know, all sorts of things. I really think the general public needs to just get a bit more of a sophisticated understanding of what's in our genomes and how they work, because it's us, it's entirely our own human story, it's what makes us who we are. And I really want to encourage everyone to find out a bit more about what's going on.
Yes, I think, and your book is a great way to do it. And I, you know, we're at the bottom of the hour, so I guess we can wrap it up and say, what a delight it's been to have Kat on.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Oh my gosh, it's been so good, and I loved reading your book. And like I said, every time I see a book about genes, I go, another book about genes. You know, so what twist will this person take to draw me in, you know?
It's got dick jokes.
It does. I teach a class to high school teachers about genomics, and so I will tell them, this book is wonderful, but please don't just hand it to your students. Well, they might love it, but their parents might not.
This is probably the only genetics book that needs one of those parental advisory stickers on it.
I suppose.
Well, like I said, it's not the kids who will have, well, maybe a few, but some parents are like, oh my goodness, so am I. So, but anyway, this book, Herding Hemingway's Cats, Understanding How Our Genes Work, is really, it's a delight. It's in a conversational tone. I mean, literally, she's having conversation with scientists, and it brings you up to date. So if you sort of, the last book you read about genomics was The Genome, Autobiography of a Species by Matt Ridley from 10, 12 years ago, I say you need an update, and this is the book to do it. So, So on behalf of myself and my co-host Jeff, thank you to all of you who were able to tune in. I got some feedback online that there was some buffering issues and things slowing down, so I'm sorry about that. I have nothing to do with that. That must be on a Google level. But hopefully the YouTube video will still look wonderful. I enjoyed my conversation at least, so hopefully the rest of you will be able to watch it okay, catch it up later. So, Kat, thank you so much and for taking time out from your family visit to join us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Okay, see you guys later.